Do not cry that I have been unfair, you Irish and English and Libyans. You chose your leaders, or tolerated them. The consequences were predictable. You pay now for the failure of reason. You Irish, at least, should have known better. Like a one-crop society, you staked your survival on violence. Is the lesson of the potato blight grown so dim? As you sow, so shall you reap. John Roe O'Neill, Letter 3. It no longer bothered John that he was forced to leave the vicinity of McRae's chateau without spreading the plague there. He knew now that he was being saved from more important things at the Killaloe lab. Nemesis remained true. Jock had saved him from a terrible error. Herity was confused. Had John merely been stumbling about blindly in the dark outside the telephone hut? By his intervention, Jock had also revealed Herity's purpose. Herity was looking for O'Neill. This amused John. With Herity nearby, O'Neill within would never reveal himself. John Roe O'Neill lay subdued, blocked by a fear anesthesia. The nightmare screams were temporarily walled off. John O'Donnell could stride along with his three companions, swinging his arms freely. He felt liberated. Jock, Cullen, and four armed soldiers escorted them 2 miles down the hill, away from the chateau, before returning their weapons. Herity checked his machine gun carefully, then looped its supporting strap around his neck. John merely slipped the pistol and ammunition into a hip pocket and pulled the yellow sweater over it. They parted at a crossroads where a signpost still pointed the way to Dublin. Jock gestured to the sign with the rifle. "You know the way. Don't come back." The consequences of disobedience did not have to be spoken. The escort turned and marched back up the hill, leaving John and his companions in the stone-bordered roadway. There were tall pines all around, but meadows could be glimpsed ahead where the road led down off the ridges. John glanced at Herity. The man was like that Japanese toy, the little dumpling doll with weights glued into its rolling bottom. 6 times down, 7 times up. He would always return to the upright position. John felt amused by the idea of Herity returning to a standing position, though dead. Something bitterly tenacious in him. Dangerous. He might be confused, but he would not stop hunting. "Let's be gone," Herity said. He waved them ahead and aimed a kick at the boy, which the boy dodged. In that instant, John recognized the source of Herity's irritation with the boy. Here was a young lad's flesh, the shape and form that Herity could identify, but without animation, except for that slumbering rage. The flesh was clumsy, like a mechanical toy left to run down, and with its spring now almost unwound. "Do something definite," Herity was saying. That was why Herity's anger had been subdued by the boy's attack at the wash-house. Something definite. Within a mile they came to a Y-branch in the road. No signpost here. Herity took the right-hand way, but Father Michael stopped, the boy with him.
"Now just a minute, Joseph. That's the long way by a good many miles."
Herity didn't even pause.
"We've been ordered to deviate via Dublin."
Father Michael hurried to catch up, but the boy lagged behind with John.
"Why?" Father Michael demanded. "Who said?"
"Jock said. Orders from Dublin." Father Michael glanced back at John, then at Herity.
"But..." "Be still, you crazy priest!"
There was frustration in Herity's voice. He quickened his pace, forcing Father Michael almost to trot. Their footsteps sounded muffled on the paving, enclosed by the border of thick trees and rock walls. John sensed a new tension in Herity's manner. Quick glances left and right, the machine gun held ready in his hands. Father Michael hitched his pack higher and fell back slightly. Herity eased his long strides, peering up and around. John looked up through the trees. A peculiar light in the morning sky, as though everything came through a gray filter. Distances were muzzy in diffusion, everything caught up in a sea-driven mist from the east. The sky directly overhead spread out a dark silver shaded into lighter steel eastward. Breakfast lay heavy in John's stomach, fresh beef and boiled nettles with potatoes. The chateau's guardians had set aside for their mess a small stone cottage of what had obviously been a substantial farmstead on a ledge cut off from McRae's establishment by a long slanting ridge. The cottage's interior walls had been crudely knocked out, opening space for a long table and rude benches. The food, cooked on a turf fire, had been served just after dawn, only John's group and the escort at table. Harrity had arrived last with Jock beside him, the younger Cullen uneasy and trying to avoid conversation. But Harrity had been full of questions. John had eaten quietly, listening. There were things to be learned here. Liam had been called away by his command duties. The other guardians already were posted for their day duty around the chateau. The other soldiers at the table, sensing something different in Jock's manner, kept a quiet watch. Slowly tensions began to mount in the stone-walled cottage. Father Michael broke the silence. "God is putting us through a sore test." The words sounded forced, leaving an even more intense silence behind them. "Sure, Father. And which plague did you have in mind?" Harrity asked. "Was it the plague of the papacy now?" He spoke with unswerving arrogance. "What's the use of blame?" Father Michael asked.
"Him asking such a question?"
Harrity laughed.
"We've much to answer for," Father Michael said. "The British planted a bad seed amongst us, but I ask you now, where was that seed nurtured? Was it not ourselves seeing the fruit and plucking it from the branches?"
"Eve's apple it is," Harrity said.
"Only we called it the Provos of the IRA," Jock said. "A beautiful red apple with a bomb in it."
Harrity's jaw clamped tight. A flush spread over his face. He put both hands on the table. Violence wavered in the air.
"Have done," Father Michael said. "Are we not all paying the piper now?"
"Let us pay him then and have our little dance," Jock said. "Will you dance with me, Joseph?"
"Enough," Father Michael thundered. "I'll curse the first one of you taken to violence."
Jock swallowed convulsively, then in a low voice,
"Mayhap you are right, Father. Best it were over and the world going on without such mischief."
Harrity glowered at the priest.
"I don't fear your curses, Michael Flannery.
But I'll honour the truth in young Jock. He sees the way of things."
Father Michael sighed.
"Joseph, you were a God-fearing man once. Will you never come back to the church?"
Harrity stared into his cold stew, oddly subdued by the sudden quenching of Jock's fire.
"I've lost me faith, and that's what huddles me, true enough."
"Then why—"
"Shut your fool mouth, priest. I've no more respect for clerics, not after Maynooth. I'd sooner melt their bells for drinking mugs than spend another minute in one of your churches."
He pointed a death's head grin at Father Michael.
"And if you call that blasphemy, I'll tip you into the first well we find."
Jock had led them down through the fields away from the chateau, dew drenching their pants. They could see the paved road ahead, a farm lane entering it. There was one last glimpse of the chateau as the party rounded the barrier ridge. It was a grey castle wall nestled in the trees. Faintly, they heard the sound of children shouting. Jock looked over his shoulder at the distant sound, pausing by a stile while the others climbed over onto the farm lane. As John passed, Jock looked at him.
"It was mostly the girls learned the Irish dances," he said. "They do their dances of a morning up there."
He pointed toward the chateau with his chin.
"If we lose those girls, we've lost it all. All of those beautiful dances. I think I can forgive McRae anything if we don't lose that."
After Jock left them, John's thoughts kept returning to those words, the half-hopeful sadness in them.
Herity continued to march along at the point, an advanced scout with his machine gun at the ready. Father Michael trailed behind him. John and the boy kept pace at the rear. The road made a sharp left turn up ahead out of the flanking trees. Straight ahead beyond the turn, grass tufted around a jutting mound of pale granite. Herity stopped, motioning the others to stop behind him. John looked past Herity, wondering what had spooked him. All he could see was two sheep on a grassy shelf below the rocks. The sheep stared up at them, full of alarm.
"It's only some sheep," Father Michael said.
Herity waved a hand for silence. He studied their surroundings, the mounded hillocks below the outcropping, the empty valley beyond, a narrow place with a boggy stream down its middle.
"It's a wonder it is that you're not dead long ago, Michael Flannery," Herity said. "Whatever it is bothers those sheep should bother us."
"And what might be bothering them?" the priest asked.
"I wonder where Liam went this morning," Herity asked. "Let us be going back a ways, and silent as the tomb about it."
Herity backed up the road, keeping his attention on the rock and the sheep. John turned and walked beside him, glancing backward occasionally. Father Michael and the boy went on ahead, not looking back at Herity.
"What is it?"
John asked. He felt for the pistol in his hip pocket, but thought better of it and removed his hand empty.
"It's only men that's hunting the sheep for their meat nowadays," Herity said. "Something frightened those creatures before we came along."
"Probably just some of Liam's soldiers out foraging," John said.
"Foraging for what?" Herity asked.
Father Michael stopped ahead of them and turned.
"Something passed between you and Liam Cullen," he said. "What was it?"
"Dublin gave him his orders to let us go safely on our way," Herity said, glancing once sidelong at John.
"It wouldn't be like Liam to disobey such orders where there's others to see and inform."
"You're not serious," Father Michael protested.
"Liam and me was wains together," Herity said. "I knew the child, and I know the man. Who's to question if he does a bit of foraging here in this valley? Answer me that, priest."
They had stopped at a place where rocks had been tumbled from the top of the road's bordering wall on the valley side. Herity crossed to this place and peered over the wall into the trees.
"A trail of sorts," he said. "I think we'll be going down this way."
Father Michael joined him.
"You call that a trail? It has a great advantage for us," Herity said. "You can see by the marks on it that no one's passed that way today."
The priest shook his head.
"I can't believe that Liam Cullen would shoot all—"
"Leave off, will you now? Liam's a soldier. Why is it, you think, the valley back yonder has no folk in it? Run off or killed by Liam and his boys. And in this valley, too.
I know the inside of Liam's head. There's no stories to be carried if there's no one to carry 'em."
"But we knew about—"
"Knew? Rumours and little bird droppings from them as hears the council's deliberations. We knew nothing."
Herity lifted a foot over the wall and hopped across. Father Michael joined him. John and the boy followed. The trail was a dark hole down through mixed evergreens, the ground pocked by sheep hooves, but no sign of a human footprint. Tufts of wool clung to the low branches like the markers of a paper chase. The way was steep with exposed roots. With Herity leading, they slid and clambered down, grasping limbs to slow their descent, clinging to roots in the steeper parts. The trail emerged from the trees onto a grassy ledge with man-made steps of rock down to a sloping meadow. A stone cottage with only half a roof sat in tall grass about 50 meters into the meadow. Beyond it, a series of rock-shelved terraces curved away to the right through closely bordering trees. A sunken, weed-filled wagon track ran along the terraces at the bottom. It led to an angle, left to right, through two gates that had been left standing open. John brushed needles and dirt off him while he looked at the scene. It was like a still life. Title, Dreams Abandoned.
"There's something you never saw in the Irish countryside,"
Father Michael said, his voice low.
"Gates left open."
"Hush now,"
Herity whispered. He moved down through the meadow to the house, drifting through the tall grass like a deer stalker. John followed and heard the priest and the boy swishing through the grass behind him. Herity headed for the first open gate into the wagon track. They passed the ashes of what probably had been a small byre with a pile of manure beside it. Grass grew thick on the manure, and bushy weeds already were sprouting in the burned area. The wagon track sloped up to the right along the rock walls of the terraces, which stepped down from twice a man's height to only waist height about 200 meters ahead. As they passed the second terraced step, the view was opened across stone-walled meadows and the road they had abandoned, then up the far side of the road to a castle ruin on the opposite ridge, less than a mile away. Herity stopped.
"Ah," he said.
John stopped beside him. There was no sound of the priest and boy behind them. All were looking at the castle. It stood in a haze of trees and bushes, with only the crenellated battlements fully exposed. Behind the screening growth, splotches of color could be glimpsed on the walls. Ruined turrets and buttresses stood out against the morning sky like illustrations in a tourist brochure. John found himself thinking how sure it was that castles, even ruined ones, transformed a skyline into something cruel, as though fangs had been exposed.
"I'll have the binoculars,"
Herity said, his voice hushed. He reached back toward Father Michael while keeping his attention on the castle. Father Michael pressed the binoculars into Herity's outstretched hand.
"What is it?"
Herity did not answer. He focused on the castle, sweeping his attention across it, then stopping.
"Well, now," he whispered. "Slowly, all of you, back up into the shelter of the wall."
"What is it?"
Father Michael insisted.
"Do as I say."
Keeping his attention on the castle, Herity pressed them back up the wagon track until the terrace wall concealed them. He lowered the glasses then and smiled at Father Michael.
"It's Liam yonder with the mate to my little beauty."
He patted the machine gun on its sling against his chest.
"Now I ask you, why would Liam Cullen be looking along that road with such a weapon in his hands?"
"Ah, that sneaky man."
"What do you intend?"
Father Michael asked.
"Well, now as to that, since he hasn't seen us, him being too intent on the road where he expects us to appear, I think I'll be coming up behind Liam to ask what he's doing there away from his post at Mr. McCrae's fine house."
Herity cleared his throat and spat on the ground.
"Discouraging it is. I expected a better quality of soldiering from Liam."
"I'll go with you,"
Father Michael said.
"You'll wait here," Herity said. "You'll wait as a corpse or as a living man able to guide Mr. John O'Donnell into Dublin should anything harmful happen to me."
Father Michael started to protest, but stopped when Herity produced a long knife from his right boot.
"And should I be forced to silence you, Michael Flannery,
I'll have to treat the boy the same. Him being without a protector, then."
Father Michael stared wide-eyed at Herity.
"I believe you'd do it."
"Ah, it's wisdom you're getting at last. Now you'll wait here where you cannot be seen."
He looked at John.
"Attend to it, if you please, John."
Herity crouched, turned, and scuttled along the low notch of the terrace, straightening only when the wagon track dipped far enough to conceal him from the castle.
"A terrible man,"
Father Michael whispered.
"Sometimes I think he's the devil incarnate."
He looked at John.
"Would he really have?"
The priest broke off and shook his head.
"I think he would."
"He's capable of it," John agreed, and wondered why he found this thought pleasing.
"Capable, yes. A fine word. And I keep forgetting that it's you who are the important one here, John O'Donnell. You must be brought safely to Killaloe. We must think always of the lab and the lives to be saved. But what of their souls?
I ask you that. What of their souls?
John felt uncomfortable with this question. The priest's voice, so gentle, but the violence under it. There was that absolute, arrogant certainty once more, the thing cemented in belief that could not be questioned. How hesitant he sounded, though, as though these words were spoken only out of a remembered role. "Then why are we going to Dublin?" John asked.
"They've a wireless back there."
He nodded in the direction of Macrae's chateau.
"I suppose orders was passed along. They'll be taking you to Killaloe in a motor car, no doubt."
John felt for the pistol in his pocket, but did not withdraw it. What if it was Liam up there intent on murder? What if Herody got himself killed? John peered around them. Open meadows with only a few stone walls behind which to hide.
"These are hard times," Father Michael sighed. "It's difficult to make decisions."
John looked to his right along the wagon track. Herody no longer could be seen there. Could I risk looking around the terrace wall at the castle? But Herody had taken the binoculars. The boy slid into a sitting position with his back against the wall beside John. Father Michael spoke in a hushed voice as though he had been carrying on a long conversation with himself and only now decided to share it.
"I blame the English, I do."
"How can we blame the madman?
Poor soul crying out against outrage, and him here on holiday not wanting to hurt even a fly."
The priest shook his head.
"Why did the English ever come here? What good have they ever done?"
John spoke absently, his mind elsewhere.
"They'd say they gave you law and constitutional government."
Where was Herody? Should they wait here, exposed like this? Was Liam really up there intent on murder?
"English law," Father Michael said. "Them speaking of tolerance. When were the English ever tolerant? Look at their bloody riots against the Packies. They've always been bigots. It's them I blame for all of this."
John spoke dryly, trying to conceal amusement.
"You were all forgiveness at breakfast." "It's a Flannery family failing," Father Michael said. "We're full of the blather before the head's awake."
He stared down the track where Herody had gone.
"What's keeping the man? He's had time enough."
"Slow and silent," John said, but he felt his own stomach nodding at the question.
"More murder," Father Michael muttered. "I wonder, did Joseph bring any of the poutine from Gannon's?"
John merely looked at him. The priest sighed.
"No people ever had better cause for turning to the drink than the Irish."
Tears sprang from his eyes and ran down his cheeks.
"My own little brother. Little Timmy telling me. The bottle is my salvation. Him speaking the words of Jimmy Joyce. Ireland sober is Ireland stiff. Ah. My blessings on ye anyway, little Timmy."
Another great sigh shook him. He brushed the tears from his cheeks and looked back the way they had come, his attention on a corner of the ruined cottage, the only part of it visible from this position.
"No one builds," he whispered. "Not any more. Until the plague, we didn't realize why we built. It was for the children. Without the children, there's nothing left of ourselves."
He fell silent then.
"Ach, where is that?"
The peculiar rippling burst of a machine gun sounded across the valley, the sound silencing the priest. John stiffened. Which machine gun? Herody's or Liam's? The boy stirred and looked up at them. John thought he might break his silence, but he only wet his lips with his tongue. Father Michael looked at John.
"Was that?"
"It was."
"Which of them?"
Father Michael whispered. John stepped over the seated boy, noting the haunted gaze which followed him. The edge of a terrace wall lay directly in front of John. A weedy vine grew between the stones. Would there be more shooting?
He eased his head out of the rocky shelter until one eye could look up at the castle.
"What is it?"
Father Michael whispered. John moved farther out, both eyes looking up at the ruin on the height. Nothing moved there except a gentle breeze stirring the screen of trees and bushes. No birds, nothing. He felt the stillness, a waiting for life to reveal itself. It seemed utter foolishness to be peering around the stone shelter this way. Father Michael tugged at John's sweater.
"What is it?"
"Nothing," John whispered.
"But that was a machine gun."
"It was, but which one of... Wait." Something had emerged on the eastern parapet of the castle ruin, a vague movement fuzzed by the intervening growth. Damn Herity for ticking the binoculars.
"What do you see?"
Father Michael demanded. He started to move around John, but John pressed him back. Something waved from the parapet. John recognized it abruptly. Herity's green jacket whipping back and forth in semaphore and... Yes, Herity's straw hair below the arms that held the jacket up like a triumphant banner. "It's Herity," John said. "He's waving for us to come up." John stepped out of the concealment and waved his arms. The jacket on the castle described one more arc and was lowered. Father Michael came up beside John.
"What is that strange coloring on the castle's walls?"
"Let's go up and see," John said. Father Michael hung back, reluctant to move.
"It's blood," he said.
"Then you'll be needed," John said. He led the way down the lane, past the second open gate, hearing the priest and boy behind him. The track curved around a wall to another open gate, and then up to the paved road. A paved drive directly opposite went up to a low wall below the castle, turning right there and up onto a flat parking area where the burned wreckage of a bus could be seen with one wheel over the wall. The whole vehicle, faded red and black, tipped at an impossible angle. Why didn't it fall? John saw it then. The front was wedged against a tree on the parking terrace. The tops of the trees grew tall, rising over a second terrace where the plantings had been allowed to run wild. Father Michael came panting up beside John, dragging the boy by one hand.
"I don't see him. Where's Joseph?"
"He's up there," John said. He held his silence until they reached the road, where he stopped and looked left and right, then laughed at himself for the habit that had made him do this. As though a car might run him down here. The drive up to the castle was paved with stones as black as the walls that lined the way. Moss and lichen grew on the stones. Grass straggled from beneath the stones and along the tops of the walls. Herity's voice called to them from the concealment above.
"Up here!"
John led the way across the parking terrace and into what revealed itself as a covered stone passage up to the castle yard. They emerged and saw the castle itself close up without its haze of trees and bushes. Someone had painted the keystones of the window arches in red-orange, the artificial color of plastic, of cheap hair dye. "There's your blood," John said. He lifted his gaze to the wall above the windows. The same paint had been used to write a scrawling message across the entire visible stretch of stone wall, crudely spattered letters in a child's block capitals, "Fuck the past." Herity emerged from a postern gate at the base of the wall. He carried two machine guns now and another pack, military green. Herity stopped when he saw John, the priest, and the boy staring at the castle wall above him. Turning, he read the words. A roaring laugh escaped him.
"There's the new Irish poetry."
He swiveled on one heel and strode across to John, thrusting the second machine gun into John's hands.
"There. Now we're both properly armed, and we may even win through to Dublin."
He slipped the new green pack off his arm and pressed it into John.
"Liam had the foresight to bring extra clips and plenty of ammo."
"It was Liam?"
Father Michael asked.
"Such a grand view from up there,"
Herity said, hooking his chin toward the castle parapet above them.
"The entire road open to him. He brought too much ammo, though.
He'd have needed only one short burst, and we'd have been pig meat.
Father Michael shook his head from side to side like a wounded animal. He opened his mouth but did not speak. Then it was forced out of him.
Damn them! That's right, priest. A good curse now and then helps things along.
Herity grinned conspiratorially at John.
It was Liam?
Father Michael demanded, tears in his voice.
You're using the proper past tense, Herity said. Was. Liam is past imperfect.
Herity chuckled at his jest.
Dead?
Father Michael insisted.
Haven't I said it?
I crept up the back way and himself watching the road so close over that little weapon there, he didn't hear me until it was too late.
Where's the body? Father Michael asked. He sounded infinitely tired.
Save your empty praying for when we've more time, Herity said. Unless you've a mind to bless the castle privy.
Father Michael stared at Herity.
What? I tipped him in with the rest of the shite, Herity said.
It'll take him a little time to find him, should they come hunting.
Herity took one of the priest's arms and turned him around, holding him where he was forced to look down at the burned bus.
It was full of people when it burned, Herity said.
A heavy military-type machine gun made those little holes below the windows. You can say a few words as we pass it on our way.
Father,
we're in a bit of a hurry just now, and we'll have to be watching our backs for Jock as we go.
Herity released his grip on Father Michael's arm and strode past him toward the steps down to the parking terrace. As he moved away from them, he exposed a dark stain down his back, the kind of stain that could have come from carrying a body from which blood still ran.
For as long as they continue to control life and death, aristocrats understand correctly that their power depends mostly on their families, and much less on the people who must be kept subservient. This is why marriage remains so important to the aristocratic clan structure. Power marries power. In this trait, aristocrats recognize each other immediately. They share a common behavioral pattern. Here is the clan economics, where the real bargaining occurs, in the still, vital dower exchange. Jost Hupp, M.D.
Bill Beckett stood looking out the window of Wycombe Finch's posh office at the Union Jack, whipping from its staff in front of the Huddersfield Administration Building. The smartly uniformed color guard who raised the flag every morning could be seen marching away toward their barracks at the perimeter station near the main entrance. A flock of wagtails flew across the marching men, turning to flash their white belly patches against the gray morning sky. He could see his reflection in the window, a blurred shape much thinner than once it had been. "It's going to rain," Beckett thought. He heard the door open behind him. Wycombe Finch's rasping voice, Joe Hupp's softly accented response. Joe was raising the issue of computer time. That was vital. Beckett could still taste breakfast. Oatcakes with a rasher of bacon. One thing to be said for Huddersfield. They ate solidly. It seemed to put no fat on him, though. Danza obviously detested local food, but had resigned himself to it. Beckett could hear Danza and Lepikov entering the office. Turning, Beckett affirmed that they were all here. The director had stopped beside the door. He closed it, turned his pale, veined face toward Beckett, and nodded. The others were busy moving chairs up to the narrow table at one side of the office, where the small conferences were held. Beckett moved across the room slowly, thinking about the sales pitch he had to make. Some things did not have to be reaffirmed, he knew. Nucleic acids were the molecules upon which the genetic coding was written. They directed the manufacture of proteins. They held the key to heredity. Heavy polymers, like proteins. The DNA was actually a doubled molecule with one chain twined around the other in helical form, but they knew now that it was not merely a two-part structure written in four-letter code. Was Hupp right? Did the two dominant parts require the presence of an igniter, which interposed itself much like a snake crawling into a hole? That would fit with Browder's maypole concept. It would require partial matches at each bonding point that would relax in the newly created medium and jiggle onward to the next step, and so on, until the moment of completion. Total ignition. Contact. But understanding such complexity required a sophisticated computer approach. And if Wycombe Finch wouldn't give them the computer time, perhaps Ruckerman could pry it out of the new president. They were never going to break this code without such help. Beckett took his seat beside Danza, looking across the table at Lepikoff and Hupp. The director pulled a chair up to the end of the table and rested his elbows there.
"We must make this decision today," Lepikoff said.
His full lips barely moved as he spoke, but the heavy eyebrows compensated, lifting and falling with each word. The director turned his head and looked at the stack of bifold computer printouts that Beckett had dumped on his desk earlier.
"That's about a third of last week's run," Hupp said. "But it's the important third."
Beckett said, "Why?" You must give us access to a great deal more computer time. It's slowing us down, this standing in line for...
You really think you're reproducing the structure?
Wycombe Finch asked. He brought his pipe out of the side pocket of his tweed jacket, a sure signal that he was prepared to stand firm and make this a long session.
We have a toe in the door, Beckett said.
The director knew this expression, but wondered at its accuracy. He filled his pipe and lighted it, watching the coal as it glowed under his lighter.
"Are we certain there are no women available for tests in all of England?" Danza asked.
"Too early to face that problem, don't you think?" the director said. He looked at Beckett, pulse quickening at this turn. How close was this team?
"We'll need test subjects eventually," Beckett said.
"No women we can safely get at, I'm assured," Wycombe Finch said. "Some will be provided, I'm certain, when the time comes. The Americans, perhaps? I'm told they have quarantine stations staffed with—"
"We dare not ask," Lepikoff said.
Danza stroked his long nose with a forefinger and nodded agreement.
"We've discussed this at some length," Hupp said. "The United States, the Soviet Union, China. There is nowhere we dare turn. They would know immediately that we had achieved a breakthrough."
"I'm familiar with that theory," Wycombe Finch said, speaking around his pipe stem and a long curl of blue smoke. "But how close are we?"
Hupp shrugged.
"A toe in the door doesn't mean we've made the sale," Beckett said. The director removed his pipe from his mouth.
"Let us say that I do as you suggest, increase your access to computer time. By how much we will not estimate for the sake of this hypothetical consideration, but let us say I do it. What then?
If you give us enough time at the computer, you'd better start arranging immediately for test subjects," Beckett said.
"What about that woman in the tank at Killaloe?" Hupp asked. "Her husband called me recently, you know. I didn't raise the question with him, but it crossed my mind."
"Just exactly what is it you fear from the major powers?" Wycombe Finch asked. Beckett cast a long-suffering look at Hupp. They had been through this several times with the director. The man was stalling, weighing his options. Hypothetical consideration. It was one of Wycombe Finch's more irritating characteristics. He refused to act swiftly and decisively. Another damn bureaucrat.
"If we let it be known that we have solved the plague," Hupp said, "the world's major powers would face several attractive choices, arguing from their individual and selfish viewpoints. First, each would assess how well its female population was protected from conventional attack. Once the females are immunized, they can be considered a national asset, to be sequestered in protective custody.
Under circumstances that would have been considered most unacceptable in pre-plague times, Danzar said.
We could expect commando-style attack right here, Beckett said. They'd want to control us.
Even if they learn that we've achieved something, Lepikov said, we cannot broadcast the solution widely. It must be confined to this facility.
You're really serious about this, Wycombe Finch said, a faint querulousness in his tone.
The Soviet Union would consider the statistical advantage in knocking out existing and potential adversaries, Lepikov said. If you can cure the plague, and especially if you understand the other implications in this, the first strike becomes an exceedingly attractive option. Certainly this establishment becomes immediately expendable.
Wycombe Finch looked at Beckett. You share this opinion?
Any atomic power becomes exceptionally dangerous to us under these circumstances, Beckett said. It hinges on something we here cannot possibly know. How well they have protected their female populations.
Any other population segment could be freely sacrificed, Lepikov said.
Hutt leaned forward.
They've already taken such losses that they are all operating from a reserve position. People backed against the wall tend to make dangerous decisions.
Wycombe Finch scratched his jaw with his pipe stem.
Military thinking, Lepikov muttered. It is the same everywhere.
As was his pattern, Danzar cleared his throat and looked at each person at the table, signaling that he was about to make a pronouncement.
You must also consider what might be done by a nation such as Argentina or India, a nation whose potential for disastrous decisions does not have what Bill would call a sufficient track record from which to predict behavior. Such a nation might ignite conflict between superpowers, hoping to sit on the sidelines and pick up the pieces.
Wycombe Finch picked a fleck of tobacco from the outside of his pipe bowl.
An interesting theory. Mad. Madness is contagious, Hupp said. As contagious as the plague itself. O'Neill has loosed a second plague upon our world. This madness.
Governments are sure to think in terms of rebuilding the world's gene pool from their own stock, Beckett said. And once they know how to manipulate the DNA the way O'Neill did... He shook his head.
More plagues? Wycombe Finch asked.
Why not? Hupp countered.
Danzar nodded his head, a curiously angular motion like the bobbing of a child's toy. Wycombe Finch reached behind him to a small side table and brought a large ashtray there into position before him. He knocked out his pipe in it and refilled the pipe.
"What if it is O'Neill in Ireland?" he asked.
"And the Irish get him to cooperate?" Beckett asked, his voice weary.
"Indeed," the director said.
He lighted his pipe and puffed at it.
"You heard my conversation with Doheny," Beckett said.
"I say the odds are strongly against them getting O'Neill to cooperate, if that's really O'Neill. I mean, my God, they've had him how long? 4 months?"
"But what if it is O'Neill, and he has arranged other plagues for us?" Wycombe Finch asked.
"The world will need facilities such as this more than ever," Lepikov said. "Why do we not recognize our worth, our great value?"
Wycombe Finch said, "That seems to me the decisive argument against any attack upon us. What I fear is that someone else may achieve a cure before us."
"That's a different game, all right," Beckett said. He had been hoping the director would be the one to raise this possibility.
"What about our computer time?"
Wycombe Finch exhaled a cloud of blue smoke and stared down at his pipe. He had not reached his present position without understanding the interplays of political power, but the uses of that power had always filled him with disquiet. He knew such things as were being discussed here could occur, did occur.
His own particular regimen, however, had always been to offer no threat to those immediately superior to him, and, at the same time, to operate within a circle of steady, consistent achievement. He thought of this as the essence of the scientific method. Intuition, imaginative leaps, all such things he saw as threatening to the orderly march of science. Wycombe Finch did not like to contemplate a disorderly world, but this, he realized, was unfortunately the nature of the world at present. O'Neill had thrown a spanner into the works. True men of science could only hope to restore order, and something would have to be done to limit the disruptive consequences of scientific discoveries, something none of the others at this table had even considered, he thought. The members of the DIC team stared at him expectantly. "I shall announce new apportionments of computer time in the morning," Wycombe Finch said. He looked at Beckett. "We must proceed in an orderly fashion, old boy. Give me a night to study the situation." He gestured with his pipe at the computer printouts on his desk. "I dare say there's some food for cogitation in that lot." Beckett sighed. It was not what he had hoped for, but it was something. The director would give them a bone, more time in some form. It looked like the ball was in Ruckerman's court, though. Could Ruckerman do it without tipping their hand? The spider is curtain-bearer in the palace of Khosrows. The owl sounds the relief in the castle of Afrasiab. Saadi. The third week out from Macrae's, Herity stopped them at nightfall beside a small one-room cottage hidden from the road by a hillock. They reached it on an overgrown track through the inevitable granite walls. John found himself pleasurably anticipating walls and a roof overhead. They had spent the previous night fireless, crouched in an abandoned hay-shed while wind drove the rain around them. Inside, the cottage smelled of mildew, but the windows remained unbroken and the door sealed tightly. Herity came back from scouting the area to report there was no fresh food, not even chickens wandering in the yard to lead them to a nest of eggs. A broken-legged table propped by a length of green limb stood in front of the fireplace. Father Michael found dry peat in an adjoining shed, kindling on a shelf beside it, and soon had a fire going. "I haven't seen any signs of pursuit," Herity said, his tone pensive. "No assurance in that. We'll mount guard again tonight." Father Michael went to his pack in a corner near the fireplace and extracted a package wrapped in plastic. "Here's that piece of pork," he said. The boy sat down on the floor beside the fire and extended his hands toward the warmth. Herity put his pack next to John's beside the door, glanced at the machine gun propped against it, and smiled. He looked around the room. No loft, only this one small enclosed space. John went to one of the two windows opposite the door and stared westward at the darkening sky. Sunset through the clouds filled the air with a dim yellow light that disappeared even as he watched. Distant forks of blue lightning danced under the clouds like shapes drawn by children. The lightning appeared unreal until he heard the crumping detonation of the thunder. He counted the seconds between flash and thunder. 10 and crump. The next count was shorter. The storm was approaching fast. Father Michael opened his plastic package on the table. "It's cozy with a fire," he said. Herity picked up his machine gun and, leaving his pack, ducked out the door. "Now where's he off to?" Father Michael asked. "Only one door in this cottage," John said. "He doesn't care for that." "Windows on three sides," Father Michael said. "I suppose it's still a trap." "Do you suppose, John, that he really killed Liam?" John merely looked at him. Father Michael sighed. He rummaged once more in his pack and brought out some of Gannon's cheese. "I'd not want Joseph's sins on my soul," he muttered. There was a decayed, rancid odor from the pork, John noticed. Spoiled, no doubt of it. Didn't the priest know? "I wish Mr. Gannon and his little family well," Father Michael said. "I'll pray for them tonight." John thought of Gannon. that single pistol shot. Suggestive. Gannon had been a man ready to die, anxious for it even, too sensitive and deep for these times. How had Gannon judged the four strangers who'd taken over his household so abruptly and then left him? Did he see a group personality in us? Father Michael went to stand near the boy, both of them staring into the orange glow of the peat fire. Why are we together? John tried to visualize Herity, the priest, the boy, and himself as Gannon had seen them. Groups were supposed to have a social identity. A philosopher would try to fathom that identity. Lightning struck nearby, the thunder close and loud. The darkness outside seemed thicker, more dense afterward. They were four different people bound together for different reasons, John decided. The lack of symmetry in the group bothered John. There was a dangerous disparity here. Was it Herity, the hunter, who did not belong? It felt no better with him outside. Rain began to pour onto the cottage roof. A leak near the wall opposite the fireplace produced a steady drip, drip, drip that splashed toward the packs by the door. John moved them under one of the windows, resting the machine gun firmly on the pack that Herity had taken from Liam. It came to John that each of them was being carried along by an obsession. I must do O'Neill's bidding. The boy had his vow of silence. Herity was a hunter. And Father Michael, yes. The priest was looking for his religion. The thing holding this party together contained something unnatural, John decided. Was it supernatural? He felt that it was important to fathom what held them all together. The rain had become very loud on the roof, but the thunder and lightning were moving off to the northeast. John recorded this with only part of his awareness. His musings were no idle fantasy, he thought. The old uncanny of this land, the supernatural of little folk and fairies upon which Herity constantly harped, were gone. They had been replaced by something inescapably real, naturally super. I did that. I did it for O'Neill. Where is that Joseph Herity gone to? Father Michael asked, a whine in his voice. Waiting out the rain in some shelter, probably, John said. The rain seems to be slackening a bit, Father Michael said. It's a mild winter. Should we wait for him before we eat? If you wish. Silence settled over the room with only the faint hissing of the peat fire in the background, the rain on the roof reduced to a light pattering. John became conscious of a second leak dripping near the first one. The boy snuffled loudly. Abruptly the door burst open and Herity entered swiftly, closing the door behind him. He wore a light poncho, which dripped a wide, wet stain on the floor. There was a wild look in his eyes. He shook wetness off his green cap. "We're not followed," he said. He slipped the poncho over his head, dropping the cap to the floor with a damp plop. Under the poncho, the machine gun hung by its neck sling, but their attention was caught by a string bag slung from Herity's left shoulder. It contained three white plastic bottles and a jumble of canned food, the pre-plague commercial variety with bright labels. "Now where did you find that lot?" Father Michael asked. Herity grinned. "Provender, for those on the run. We've buried caches of it all over Ireland." "You've been this way before, then," Father Michael said. "That I have." He hung his poncho on a peg beside the door and plopped the string bag onto the table, sending it teetering precariously on its propped leg. "Gannon's cheese," he said, looking at the table. "A good supper that'll make, but the meat's high. Would you be making us all sick, priest?" "I don't like to throw away food." "Ah, we still remember the starvation times, don't we?" Herity said. He picked up the packet of meat in its plastic wrapping and dropped it onto the fire. The grease flared briefly, sending an acrid smell of rancid pork and burned plastic through the room. Herity peered across the room at John, standing near a window. "You know what pork smells like, burning, John? Same as we would." John remained silent. Parody took up a slab of hearth bread and covered it with cheese. The priest and the boy came up to the table and followed Herodes' example. Father Michael passed a slab of bread and cheese to John, saying, "Bless this food, Lord, for the keeping of our flesh." John ate beside the window, staring outside. The storm had moved across the hills, taking the rain with it. The eaves still dripped glistening pellets of water, visible briefly as they passed the firelight shining out the window. The cheese had a faint tobacco smell, and it tasted sour. John felt, rather than heard, Herody come up beside him. Herody's breath smelled of the sour cheese and something else. John sniffed. Whiskey. John looked squarely at the man in the orange firelight. Herody's eyes were steady, no faltering in his movements. "I've noticed, John, that you don't reminisce," Herody said, his voice even. "Nor do you." "You've noticed that, have you?" "Is it something you're hiding?" John asked. He felt bold in this question, safe because O'Neill within would never show himself in this man's presence. A lopsided smile twisted Herody's mouth. "The very question in me mind." Father Michael turned his back to the fire and stared across the room, his eyes in shadows. The boy returned to his position seated on the hearth. "I've been wondering," Herody said, "how you come by your knowledge of Ireland?" "A grandfather."
"Born here?"
"His father."
"Where?"
"Cork." John stopped himself on the point of repeating Grandpa Jack's story of the 700 rifles. That might already have surfaced as part of the O'Neill background. A stillness came over his entire body as he thought about this. He knew there was a certain crazy prudence in his behavior. The reasoning evaded him, though. There was a connection between O'Donnell and O'Neill. I know the things O'Neill knew. They were related, he decided. It was a troublesome relationship whose connections were to be avoided.
"So your ancestors were half Irish," Herity said.
"Full Irish."
"Both sides. Isn't that a marvel?"
"Why all these questions, Joseph?"
"Call it me natural curiosity, John. I've been wondering, I have, where it was you did all your fiddling with microscopes and test tubes and the wonderful instruments of science."
John looked at the firelight glowing around Father Michael's dark figure, the boy a motionless mound by his feet. They were like posed silhouettes.
"Well, now, he's not answering," Herity said.
"It was the University of Washington," John said. That was safe enough. The region had been hit by the panic fire even before he had left France.
"And I'll wager you were an important man," Herity said.
"Very minor."
"How is it you escaped the troubles there?"
"Vacation." Herity favored him with a long, measuring stare.
"Then you're one of the lucky ones."
"Like you," John said.
"Have you personal reasons for coming here to help?"
"My reasons are none of your business." Herity turned to stare out the window beside them. His voice carried a reflexive undertone when he spoke.
"You're right, Mr. John O'Donnell."
He aimed a twisted grin at the priest, a satanic look in the underlight from the fire.
"Isn't that the 11th commandment, Father?
Thou shalt not pry." Father Michael remained silent.
"Will you be forgiven the poor country manners of an Irishman?" Herity asked.
John stared at Herity. Jock had as much as said Herity had been in the provost. "There are all sorts of manners in our world," John said. "As Father Michael would say, you can forgive anything that doesn't cut the life out of you."
"A man of wit,"
Herity said, but his voice was bitter. Father Michael shifted position, rubbing his hands in front of him. He looked first at Herity and then at John.
"You don't know about our Joseph Herity, John."
"Be still, priest," Herity said.
"I'll not be still, Joseph."
Father Michael shook his head.
"Our Joseph was going to be an important man in this land. He studied the law, did Joseph Herity. There was them that said he might be first among us some day.
That was a long time ago, and it came to nothing, Herodie said.
What changed you, Joseph? Father Michael asked.
All the lying and the cheating.
And you there with the worst of them, Michael Flannery.
Herodie put a companionable hand on John's arm.
It's a cold floor, but a dry one, John.
I'll watch until midnight, and then you can stand awake until dawn. Best we start early and go overland instead of the road. There's trails, you know.
Hunted men always learn where the trails are, Father Michael said.
And they learn to avoid men who talk too much, Herodie said.
He took up his machine gun, slipped his poncho over his head, and looked distastefully at the wet cap on the floor. Rain no longer beat against the roof. He put the cap on the hearth near the fire and straightened, stretching. The machine gun made a sharp outline under the poncho as he moved.
"Keep the fire," he said.
"I'll do me watching from outside."
With that, he crossed to the door and let himself out.
"We had grand hopes for him once," Father Michael said.
Using his pack as a pillow, he lay down with his feet toward the orange glow of the peat fire. The boy lay curled up like a hedgehog, his head in the anorak, a dark mound at a corner of the fireplace. John followed the priest's example, his thoughts filled with Herodes's sharp questioning.
"You don't reminisce."
The man was carefully observant. John began reviewing their conversations, the things they said as they walked. Nothing casual came from Herodie. John realized belatedly that the man was a trained interrogator, getting his answers from the reactions he saw as much as from the words he heard. He studied the law, the rough manners, the country accent, part of an elaborate pose. Herodie went deep. John fell asleep wondering what he might have revealed to that watchful man. Much later, John awoke thinking he had heard a strange sound. He groped for the machine gun on the floor beside his pack, felt the cold metal. He took a deep breath, smelling the close odors of themselves in the confined space. An attar of human sweat distilled from their long tramp and the fatigue that sent them sprawling into sleep whenever they could. He sat up in the darkness and shifted the machine gun to his lap. A snort nearby. Snoring. The fire was out. The room was a black confinement that focused on a sudden sound of scratching. A match flared, and John looked into Herodie's face less than a meter away.
"You're awake," Herodie said.
The match went out.
"You can keep watch from inside, John, should you prefer. There's not a sign of pursuit for more than a mile out."
John stood. There was starlight visible out the window.
"It's turned cold, it has,"
Herodie whispered. John heard him stretching out on the floor, the little movements of trying to find a comfortable position. Herodie's breathing deepened, became slow and even. The machine gun was a cold weight in John's hands.
Why had Herodie let him have this dangerous weapon? It could kill the three sleeping figures in seconds.
John went to a window and stared out into the starlit night, the pale silver of a winter meadow laid out against the dark backdrop of trees. He stood there, shifting occasionally from one foot to the other, thinking about this strange man, Joseph Herodie. The lying and the cheating. Herodie had been an idealist. He no longer was an idealist. Father Michael's question lay in John's awareness. What changed you, Joseph?
Change. Change.
John Roe O'Neill had been changed. No question about what did it. Circumstances. In time the sky lightened to the east and a red-orange sun came over the treetops. It was a perfect Japanese rising sun for a moment, spokes radiating upward through a mist. Bird sounds came from the ring of trees beyond the meadow. The growing light cast a flush over the landscape, throwing into relief a dark track of crushed grass leading off through the overgrown meadow. Herodie spoke from the floor behind him.
There's no church bells to waken us any more.
Father Michael coughed, and there was a stirring from him as he sat up.
There'll be bells again, Joseph, only to send their alarms over the towns and the countryside. Your church is dead, priest, just as dead as all the women.